Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of September. Lawrence Wright is our guest this hour, and a perfect guest to have. I recall interviewing him when his book came out in hardcover and reading it and thinking, you don't need to read any other book about why September 11 happened. He explains all of it. Lawrence spent 5 years working on his book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9-11. Traveled to the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Holland, Spain, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Sudan, as well as New York and Washington, interviewing more than 600 people, including FBI agents, CIA officers, intelligence operatives from many countries, members of Al-Qaeda and Al-Jihad. He did a profile on John O'Neill for The New Yorker, and he spent, a number of years working. This is an interesting story. He worked as a journalist. Well, he wanted to work as a journalist in Saudi Arabia. They wouldn't give him a visa, so he took a job in the kingdom to mentor young reporters at a newspaper, and it turned out to be quite a place to be because he was able to get very deeply involved in Saudi society and learn a lot about Bin Laden's hometown. The book is now out in paperback. It was published in 2006, spent 8 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction and a number of other awards. He premiered his one-man play, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, at the New Yorker Festival in 2006, and he also had a six-week run of this play at the Culture Project in Soho. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He and his wife taught English for 2 years at the American University in Cairo in the early 70s. He had co-written a movie, The Siege, starring Denzel Washington, Bruce Willis, and Annette Bening, which appeared in theaters in 98. That movie anticipated attacks on America by Islamic terrorists and the damage the attacks would cause to our country and our civil liberties. He had the opportunity to speak to agents in the New York office of the FBI and hear their anxieties. And when he watched the attacks on a Tuesday morning 6 years ago today, he said, "This looks like a movie." And then I had the sickening realization, he says, "That looks like my movie." Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Lawrence. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's good to talk to you again.
About, exactly 6 years ago, probably right about this time, you sent an email to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, saying, "Put you to work." And what did he say, and where'd you go?
You know, at that time, I was really trying to get out of journalism. I was felt like I'd written everything I needed
to say.
And I was getting into the movie business. And so I sent an email to David Remnick, the editor, and I said, "Just put me to work." And we had a conference call that afternoon with New Yorker writers who were scattered all over the place. And you remember that the planes were grounded and we were all stuck. And I was in Austin, Texas, where I live, 1,500 miles away from the scene of the crime. But the object was, at that point, it was Tuesday. We usually close on Thursday at the New Yorker, and we had to tear up the issue and find a way to write about this massive tragedy. And I was fortunate to locate a young man named Kurt Yelson, who had was a young reporter. He had for the first time in his life slept through his subway stop.
Oh my.
And he was on his way to the World Trade Center to a conference on top of the building on the 106th floor at the windows on the World restaurant, and he ran into the building and ran up to the elevator, knowing he was late. And the elevator operator held the door for a woman who was walking across the lobby very slowly. And Kurt looked at the time on his cell phone, it's 8:46. And just as she stepped into the elevator, he noticed that she had a rose tattoo on her ankle. And he thought to himself, "Oh, wow." And then the plane hit. And the doors accordioned, they didn't close. But he walked out into the lobby, and he was disoriented, and no one knew what had happened. And he walked out, and he thought he was going outside, but he went out on a terrace, and it was covered with shoes. And he looked around, and he saw something that looked like luggage But he realized it was torsos, human torsos. And suddenly he saw people jumping all around him. And his story of escaping the World Trade Center and getting home to Queens became the bookend of the black issue that The New Yorker wrote that week.
Mm. And I had that issue on my desk for so long. The cover of that issue, too, said so much, didn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you certainly didn't stop writing. There,
no.
Then there you were for the next 5 years traveling all over the world.
Yeah, it's interesting. There I was that I thought I was no longer going to be a journalist, and I found myself in the middle of the most important story that I'd ever gotten involved in.
Yeah. Tell the story, Stuart, because I think about him, actually, every now and then, and mostly because of how you wrote about him, the story of John O'Neill, who really knew about bin Laden, who knew about Al-Qaeda, who was almost obsessed with it, and who died on September 11. Tell his story.
I came upon John's story. There I was trying to find a way to write about this massive tragedy in a human way. So I was looking online at the obituaries that were streaming in by the hundreds, and on the Washington Post site, I found a brief obit for John O'Neill, who had been the head of the FBI's counterterrorism section in New York and was really in charge, therefore, of the pursuit of bin Laden. He had been forced out of the Bureau because he had taken some classified information out of the Bureau offices, and which was true. He had done that. And he had resigned and taken a job as the head of security at the World Trade Center. And I read that and I thought, well, I don't know if he's a hero or a villain as it makes him sound. But, you know, instead of getting bin Laden got him. And that is a story. It's a tragedy. And through his story, I can write about why we failed to stop this, this terrorist attack. It turned out that O'Neill was a brilliant, flawed prophetic individual who was speaking out about the dangers of Al-Qaeda early on, long before anyone else in the Bureau took it seriously. In fact, he became a nag, and people were outdone with his obsession with Osama bin Laden.
And I know that you were working on a movie about him as well. Is that still in the works, Lawrence?
It's still in the works.
Is it?
It's now looking for a director. I don't, that's out of my hands, Kathleen.
Yeah. Yes, I think it would be a wonderful movie. So he knew, and you write in the prologue to this book, the most frightening aspect of the threat was the fact that almost no one took it seriously.
Yeah.
He took it seriously, few others. Why didn't anybody take this seriously?
Well, start with a bearded man in a cave in Afghanistan declaring war on America. It seemed comical.
Right.
There were people like O'Neill who recognized that this could be a problem, and starting with the bombing of the American embassies in 1998, that awakened some, but not all, of our intelligence community to the real danger that Al-Qaeda posed to America. We responded to that by sending in 79 cruise missiles to Afghanistan, where the Al-Qaeda camps were, and then also into Khartoum, where we blew up a pharmaceutical plant, killed a night watchman. Unfortunately, that plant had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. And in Afghanistan, a handful of people were killed. That response, unfortunately, had the effect of elevating bin Laden's status all over the world.
Hmm.
And even in Kenya, where most of the victims of the bombing of the American embassy were Kenyans. 150 people were blinded by the flying glass. But in the streets of Nairobi, a few months later, after the cruise missiles, you had kids wearing bin Laden T-shirts.
Hmm. The story of all of these people, you really talk about a couple of the personalities here that history, in some measure, is that we can look at this event through the personalities of some, obviously bin Laden being one of these, and the choices that he faced. I was interested in one part of the book where you talk about the fact that he was kind of tired of all of this business. He was thinking maybe he was going to have a farm for a while, right?
Oh, he was a big farmer when he was exiled in Sudan from 92 to 96. He was probably the largest landowner in Sudan, and he would walk around Khartoum showing off his sunflowers, which he thought should be in the Guinness Book of World Records because they were so massive. He was very proud. And at that point, al-Qaeda was really an agricultural organization. Most of his men were working in his fields and in his businesses.
Mm-hmm. And he was shaped in some way by the Egyptian doctor, and the story about him and his time in prison is fascinating as well, the brains behind al-Qaeda.
Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two guy, who is a medical doctor, and is really the propagandist and the chief organizer of al-Qaeda. It was Zawahiri, who was involved in the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, in 1981. In a small way, he was convicted of smuggling arms. But he spent 3 years in prison, along with hundreds of other Islamists. And they were brutally tortured in prison. And I think that that is a turning point in the history of al-Qaeda. It's what marks it. Separates it from any other terrorist group is this appetite for blood. Mm. They really want to kill as many people as possible. And that wasn't true of Ayman al-Zawahiri before he went into those Egyptian prisons. And the nature of the torture was, you know, they were locked in cages with wild, starving dogs and hung by their arms behind their backs for hours on end, so that some of these guys still can't tie their shoes. There's a great deal of physical humiliation. And when Zawahiri came out of that prison, he really, before, he had wanted a swift surgical military coup, and when he came out, he just wanted to kill as many people as possible.
And he convinced bin Laden that that was the way to go?
Bin Laden had a dream, and they were, you know, they were companions in Peshawar, Pakistan, during the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan. In 1988, when the Soviets announced that they were going to withdraw from Afghanistan, bin Laden had this this vision of creating an all-Arab foreign legion, using the young men who had come there to fight against the Soviets. He would take them, recruit them into this military force, and chase the Soviets into Central Asia, and then fight the communist government that was then in control in Yemen. Well, that was his vision, but he didn't have any way of putting it into effect. He didn't have the men. He didn't have the expertise. So Zawahiri had those. Since 1966, when he had started a cell to overthrow the Egyptian government when he was 15 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
Zawahiri had been cultivating military men, police officers, technocrats, other medical people like himself. And he had created a terror cell called Al-Jihad. And he surrounded this rich, charismatic young Saudi with his dream. He surrounded that man with his Egyptians. And really, to this day, al-Qaeda is an Egyptian organization with a Saudi head.
Isn't it? What do you think when you see these videotapes now, 6 years later, that Osama bin Laden, one's coming out today, one a couple days ago.
Yeah.
What do you think when you see those, Lawrence?
Well, you know, al-Qaeda is, bin Laden in particular, they're struggling to remain relevant. Al-Qaeda Central has been much reduced, but it's still able to operate. And that's the fundamental message of these videotapes, is that we are still here, we are still in a war against the West. I think, you know, one of the goals of bin Laden is to keep Americans on edge, even when he may not be able to carry out these spectacular attacks that he would like to be able to do. in many respects, the fact that Al-Qaeda has, you know, these grand ambitions for America is part of what keeps us safe, because they don't want to fritter away the dramatic impact of 9/11 with a series of, for instance, shopping mall bombs or, mm-hmm. you know, those kinds of things would be very paralyzing mm-hmm. in this country. And in many respects, we've been kind of protected by the fact that they're so ambitious and want to have such massive symbolic strikes as 9/11.
Tell me, as Petraeus is talking yesterday and today, there's discussion about Iraq and Iraq being a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and whether or not Al-Qaeda was in Iraq before we went into Iraq, etc. What's going on with Al-Qaeda in Iraq right now?
There are ancient ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, but they're complicated. And I think it's worth spending a moment to explain that. Saddam Hussein would love to have recruited Al-Qaeda. In fact, he sent emissaries to Sudan when bin Laden was there, and then to Afghanistan when he was there, proposing that they work together. But bin Laden hated Saddam Hussein. He preached against him even in the late 80s and the early 90s before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So there was no actual connection between the two men, despite the overtures. Now, when I was working on my book, I was puzzled by the fact that there were, you know, Egyptians, there were Gulf Arabs, you know, and there were Libyans and Moroccans in Al-Qaeda, but there were, I couldn't find Syrians, Jordanians, Palestinians. You know, that was a mysterious absence. As it turns out, there was a competing group in Afghanistan led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who had people from that region in his camps, not in the Al-Qaeda camps. After the invasion of Afghanistan by American and coalition troops in 2001, he took refuge, Zarqawi did, in Iran. And then he went to Iraq and joined a group called Ansar al-Islam. And he broke away from that later, and he formed his own group. It was that group that began the war on the Shiites through the bombing of the Shiite mosque while people were at prayer. It was that group that took this level of barbarism to a new height by cutting off the head of an American contractor and posting a video of it on the Internet. And then he made application to join Al-Qaeda formally. He submitted a note to Osama bin Laden pledging his loyalty. And it took about a year for bin Laden to accept the application, and he formally did so. But they were constantly in negotiation about how, you know, whether we should be attacking the Shias. What is this business of cutting off people's heads all the time? Can't you just shoot them? You know, there were public relations matters. But there certainly is an association now between Al-Qaeda and Iraq that didn't exist before our invasion.
And you talk about what you call a fourth tier of Al-Qaeda being formed from Iraq, jihadis coming out of Iraq who've been highly trained, and you're concerned about this fourth tier, aren't you?
I am. I think, you know, Al-Qaeda is very much preoccupied with Iraq right now, just as we are. Most of their attention, their resources, and so on, are going into Iraq. As we begin to withdraw, those jihadis who've gone to Iraq to get trained against the most formidable military in the history of humankind will be returning to their home countries by design, in order to topple the repressive regimes in their own countries. And Al-Qaeda hopes then to set up a caliphate that will reach across national boundaries and then establish an all-Islamic army that will engage in a final apocalyptic war with the unbelievers. And if you follow their schemes, you know, these are spun legends that they have for themselves that are meant to inspire young jihadis and terrify the West. They hope by the year 2020 to have a complete victory. In other words, that disbelief will vanish and happiness will pervade the entire world.
Lawrence Wright is our guest this hour, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, has just been published in paperback. The Christian Science Monitor says, and I wholeheartedly agree with this, it should be required reading for every American. Yes, it is that good. It's hard to imagine a better portrait of 9/11 and its causes emerging anytime soon. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We have a couple lines open for Lawrence, and we'll welcome your calls in just a minute. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we are going to talk about Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey and her endorsement and this huge party they had over the weekend. We'll have two guests with us, a professor of history from the University of Southern California and a visiting associate professor at Harvard University. So that's coming up. Lawrence Wright is with us on this sixth anniversary of September 11, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. John from Milwaukee is our first caller. Lawrence, hi, John.
Hi. One of the original reasons that we were attacked for 9/11, if I understand it correctly, was the fact that President Bush's father had put U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, which is considered the Holy Land for Islam.
Right.
And since then, if I understand it correctly, President Bush's son has removed those troops. And then in the latest video, Osama bin Laden spoke of a book of foreign policy, I think it was, that spoke specifically of things that they were upset with. And the media doesn't seem to cover it at all. They seem to pursue more of this, we want everybody to change over to Islam type of stuff. But I'm wondering, what are the specific foreign policy reasons that he was talking about in that video?
When we had a little feedback, I'm sorry, there it is better. In 1990, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and he massed troops on the Saudi border, of course, the Saudis were panicked, and bin Laden was just back from the jihad against the Soviets, and he had wrapped himself in this legend that he and his Arab Mujahideen had inflicted the wound that felled this communist empire, and which was completely untrue. They were a negligible force, but he was a kind of mythic figure in Saudi Arabia, and he walked into the Minister of Defense, and he said that he would defend the kingdom with Al-Qaeda, which must have been about 200 men at the time, and 100,000 unemployed Saudi youth, and the construction materials that is, you know, of his father's construction company, the earth-moving equipment. And the Minister of Defense, you know, was incredulous. You know, this is a million-man Iraqi army with one of the largest tank corps in the world, you know, and he laughed bin Laden out of the office. It was very wounding for bin Laden, but like many strict Wahhabis, he believes that when the Prophet was on his deathbed, he said, "Let there be no two religions in Arabia." So it was heresy in his mind and in the minds of many Muslims that half a million Christians and Jews and even more galling women came in to defend the kingdom of Saudi Arabia against Saddam Hussein. So this was the original insult that really turned him against his own royal family and against America. We made a serious mistake in Saudi Arabia when, after Saddam Hussein lost and withdrew from Kuwait, we did not remove our troops. We had negotiated treaties with other, like the UAE and Qatar, which would allow us to place our troops off of the peninsula and enforced the no-fly rule. But we were staying in very nice quarters in Saudi Arabia and simply didn't feel like moving. That was a tremendous mistake because it made us look like occupiers in the Holy Land. Now, in March of 2003, when the statue of Saddam came down, President Bush announced that we would at last remove our troops from Saudi Arabia because they were no longer needed there. But it was the very next month that Al-Qaeda began its assault on the Western housing compound in Arabia. So they had won, essentially. They had achieved bin Laden's goal of removing the troops from the Holy Land, but that wasn't enough. And I think that that was when Al-Qaeda took its turn toward this sort of apocalyptic, unappeasable stance that it now has.
Hmm. What should we do in Iraq, Lawrence? What lessens the threat of Al-Qaeda? What makes people like us better in the region? What brings peace? What the heck are we supposed to do?
My own feeling is that we should have a plebiscite in Iraq and ask the Iraqi people what we should do. We invaded without asking their permission. Polls show that they would probably ask us to leave, and I think the American people are longing to leave and would love to have the Iraqis say, just go. But I doubt that that's what the Iraqis would say. I think that when it comes right up against it, most Iraqis are desperate for any kind of order, and even though they may resent our presence there, they see that as the best opportunity for that. I feel that it would be a clarifying statement on the part of the Iraqis. For those who fight against American troops because we're occupiers, they would then have to justify their actions by, because Iraqi people had spoken. I think it would help America have a sense of resolve about whether to go or stay. That's my personal view.
Don't we already have polls like that?
Polls are, it's very difficult to a poll is different from a vote.
Mm.
And I think that if people go and dip their finger in the purple ink and say go or stay, that this would be one election that we could really benefit from.
Thanks very much for the call. Jack from Kenosha is our next caller. Hi, Jack.
Yes, good morning. I'm really interested in reading your guest book. It sounds fantastic. I have one question for him, if he could comment. How much do you think our view of the world and our oftentimes ignorant perception of both Al-Qaeda, Muslims, the Middle East, and everything else has contributed to the continued violence, the threats of violence from the rest of the world towards us? Because I think most Americans, and certainly in our policy, I don't think we're dealing with the world the way it is. I think we deal with the world out of a very parochial vision of what we want and what we think it should be. And my biggest fear is that our greatest danger comes from the fact that the American public doesn't seem to understand most of the rest of the world. Could you comment on that?
Well, I really agree with your observation that we engage in from a point of view of ignorance. And I'll just take the example of the intelligence community. One of the heroes in my book is Ali Sufan, who was on 9/11, was one of 8 Arabic-speaking agents in the FBI. There are 6 now.
Oh, my gosh, you're
now,
kidding.
I will point out that the intelligence community realizes that they're handicapped now because they don't have first and second generation Americans who natively speak those languages, intuitively understand those cultures. But they have not resolved the security problems, the barriers that have prevented those people from entering. Like, after 9/11, many Arabs and Muslim Americans came forward and offered their services to American intelligence, and they were spurned. But the Army picked up a bunch of them, and what happened? Of course, they went to Iraq. where they were interpreters, the most dangerous possible assignment.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to the head of the Army Translation Corps, and he said, you know, after 4 years of serving their country, they can't get a job in American intelligence because they're considered a security risk. Well, what further declaration of loyalty do they need to make? There is a security risk. It's our security that's at risk because we haven't trusted the people that could really help us to help us.
Mm-hmm. And we've had 6 years to do that, Lawrence.
It's, you know, I get very, very frustrated by this. We've got an embassy in Baghdad that has 1,000 people in it. Only 8 of them speak Arabic. How are you going to rebuild a country when you can't read the newspaper? I mean, these are tragic mistakes that we're making. And, you know, it's not just, these are not political failures. They're institutional and cultural failures that will persist for a long time after the next election.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought we all agreed that we needed more Arabic speakers after September 11. It was, everybody said, this isn't a partisan issue. Everybody said, of course we need that.
Yeah, those things were said. You know, the first thing that happened was a purge of the Arabic speakers who were gay.
Thanks, Jack, for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Jerry from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Jerry. Jerry, are you there? Where the heck are you?
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Well, we have to be very careful on 9/11 because this is a day that is becoming increasingly surrounded and entrapped by saber-rattling. And we certainly don't honor the memory of the 2,900-plus people who died in the World Trade Center by our continued presence in Iraq. And I think that if you listen to the rhetoric of your guests, El-Zarhawi became a fanatic when he was brutalized in an Egyptian prison.
Yes, I think Lawrence made mention of that. Lawrence?
I agree. I think, you know, the torture in the Egyptian prisons was, a catastrophe for Egypt and for the rest of the world because it let loose on the world a lot of people who felt that they had nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a little bit more time, because you spend a great deal of time in the book, to look at the what's been driving and what's been defining radical Islamism, Israel's victories over Arab enemies in 48 and 67, shaping the Arab intellectual universe, you write, the decline of the Arab world in the face of humiliating powerlessness, unsettling change, and stifling autocratic governments, fundamentalism provided a dam against the overwhelming, raging river of modernity.
Mm-hmm. That's what fundamentalism always does. It's whether it's in Islam or another faith. You know, the complications of the modern world, the simplicity of the message of fundamentalism, the lure of a simpler and purer time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things are at the heart of the appeal of fundamentalism in any religion.
Mm-hmm. And how do you get beyond the resentments driving radical Islamism?
I think this is going to be a long, long struggle.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, the what gives rise to radicalism in the West and in the Muslim world are slightly different. If you look at Europe right now, which I think of as being the crucible for the future of Islam, because that is where it is most confronted with the West and with modernity. It's not a clash of civilizations so much as it is a clash of identities within a civilization. I'll give you the example of Belgium, where the number one name for a new child born in Belgium today is Muhammad. Well, Muhammad is the most common given name in the world, but if you were of Flemish ancestry, probably you're wondering where this is going.
Right.
You know, what's going to happen to my little country, our history, our language? And if you're Muhammad, you're probably thinking, these people don't want me. I'll never be one of them. And maybe he never, you know, maybe he doesn't speak Arabic. Maybe he's never been to Morocco. He is lost. And there's practically nobody as lost as he. And it's not a surprise that he would go to the mosque and meet other alienated and angry young men. And for them, Islam would become more than a religion. It would become an identity. Now, that is the case in the West. In the Muslim world, there are many other factors. Start with their economies. You know, the Muslim world, 1.3 billion people. That is one-fifth of the world's population, but half of the world's poor. Just take the Arab world, 300 million Arabs. Only a few of the 22 Arab countries produce any kind of oil. If you take oil out of those economies, the 300 million Arabs produce less for export than the 5 million Finns, essentially less than the Nokia telephone company, which is the main product of export for Finland. And if you put oil back into those countries, the 300 million Arabs produce less than for their gross national product is less than that, less than half of the state of California. Now that's just the economics. There are other, the repressive governments, the gender apartheid, the lack of civil society. These are all streams that feed into this river of despair that runs through the Muslim world. And that is where Al-Qaeda rises. And in order to deal with it in a long-term sense, we have to provide hope in the way, I think, in the form of jobs, literacy, sense of openness and tolerance and progress towards democracy. Those things are very slow in coming.
And it seems as though probably the way we could do it, I mean, not that this is easy, but where we have some control over is making sure that Mohammed in Belgium feels that he's a part of Belgian society.
The Europeans are now really addressing the fact that they have failed so miserably in assimilating their Muslim minorities. You know, we should reflect for a moment on the fact that, we are so blessed in America by the Muslims and Arabs who live here. They, for instance, the average Muslim makes the average American wage. I mean, the wage scale for Muslims is much the same as it is for ordinary Americans. They're just as likely to be rich or poor as the ordinary American. They're just as likely to go to college or graduate school. They're far less likely to go to prison. Compare that to Europe, where you have these suburbs of highly impoverished Muslims around affluent cities. And in France, for instance, you've got maybe 10% of the population is Muslim. 50% of the prisoners are.
Oh my.
What a stark measure of the degree of alienation and marginality that is characteristic in Europe that is so blessedly not true here.
Lawrence Wright is our guest this hour on the 6th anniversary of September 11, author of a spectacular book about September 11, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Lawrence is an author, a screenwriter, a playwright, and a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and began this book actually 6 years ago today when he called the editor of The New Yorker, said, "Put me to work." As you heard him say earlier, he was thinking of not doing as much writing, doing more movies, and this happened, and he wound up traveling all over the world for 5 years attempting to find out about Al-Qaeda and the leadership there and the history of the organization, and he looked at the CIA and the FBI and has written a book that, well, it's the best explanation. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 and is now out in paperback. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lawrence Wright is our guest. His book is The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Martha is our next caller. Hello, Martha.
Yes, hello. Good morning, Lawrence. If you could just speak briefly on what you uncovered in your work about the ties between the CIA and bin Laden before the attacks. And then I just want to ask you a personal question. In your heart, if you truly 100% believe that John O'Neill's death was a coincidence. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay.
There were no ties between the CIA and bin Laden. in Afghanistan, we were, you know, fighting a common enemy. But there were four CIA guys running the American side of the jihad in Pakistan during that period of time, and I talked to three of them. They say that they heard that there were Arabs, you know, fighting in Afghanistan, but they were such a negligible force, and it certainly was true. I talked to a lot of Afghan commanders. They thought the Arabs were a nuisance, and they shut down their operations several times. We were supplying the Afghans with money, with arms, with Stinger missiles, but we were not supplying Osama bin Laden with any of that. The Saudis were, and the Saudis were our partner, so they were running a parallel operation. John O'Neill, you know, I'll take your question a little bit differently than the way I think you pose it. John, when he was forced to resign from the Bureau, told his friends that, you know, that he had taken this job as the chief of security at the World Trade Center. And they said, well, John, you'll be safe now, because, you know, they already tried to hit that. And he said, no, they'll finish the job.
Ooh.
And so he instinctively placed himself at ground zero. When I first heard the story of John O'Neill, I thought it was a great irony that, you know, the guy that was going to get bin Laden didn't get him, bin Laden got him. And I admit that there are people in the FBI who think that bin Laden knew he was in the Trade Center, although I don't think that was true. But I do see his death as being more like a Greek tragedy, a man who knew what fate awaited him, and he instinctively went to meet it.
Our number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in the Milwaukee area. And talk a little bit, if you would please, Lawrence, about your movie. Because the other thing that you were thinking today 6 years ago is it looks like a movie, and
yeah. And
it looked like your movie.
That was an unsettling thing.
It must have been.
Well, you know, The Siege, I wrote it, and it came out in 1998.
Hmm.
This is 3 years before 9/11, and it reflected the anxiety that a lot of the counterterrorism people that I'd interviewed had about an attack in the United States. They felt it was likely possible. At that time, I was just thinking, what would it be like if terrorism came to America at the same level that had already appeared in London and Paris, not to mention Tel Aviv or other Middle Eastern places. I just wanted, you know, how would we change? What would happen to our country? What would happen to our civil liberties? And those were the questions that the movie was posing. It was greeted with a lot of alarm by American and Muslims American Muslims and Arabs who were, I think, frightened by the prospect, and also they were sick of having all these Hollywood movies coming out that stereotyped Arabs as terrorists.
Mm.
I never felt that our movie was stereotypical in any way, but they were just waiting in line for the next movie, and you know, they greeted the appearance of the movie with protesters and so on outside the theaters, and it was a box office failure. Then it was the most rented movie in America after 9/11.
Right. Yeah, right.
I have made my peace with those protests, even though it upset me terrifically. And the one of the consequences, I believe, of the protest is that in August of 1998, when the trailers in America just began to appear about the siege and the protests were beginning, there was a bomb that went off in Cape Town, South Africa, in a Planet Hollywood restaurant. Two people were killed, and a little girl lost her leg. And a radical Islamist group claimed credit. They said that they were protesting the trailers that were in America for the siege. And Bruce Willis, who was one of the co-stars, was a partial owner of the restaurant chain. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was just hurt and angry.
Mm-hmm.
But first, you know, full of disbelief, but that this was really, there was any connection. But then when the movie finally did appear in South Africa, there were two other bombs outside of theaters. So I reluctantly accept the fact that that the protests led to the death of two people in South Africa.
Oh, that's hard to come to terms with, Lawrence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ugh. So, when you talked about the movie, one of the questions raised by the movie is how we would change. Well, now that it's happened, how have we changed?
I think we've negotiated some of our rights and privileges away in the name of safety that are going to be very hard to recapture. Some of this is, you know, just ordinary. I mean, like when I was on my book tour last year, I went to Philadelphia. And while I was there, I thought I'd go visit the Liberty Bell. Well, now when you go visit the Liberty Bell, you have to go through a scanner and empty your pockets, take off your belt. I thought, we've come to the point where you have to take off your shoes to go visit the Liberty Bell. And now you can't go up in the Statue of Liberty. I know that these are just symbols, but they represent certain deprivations of liberty and the assumptions of freedom that Americans had had for such a long time, and we've almost mindlessly given them away. And the government has been quick to overreach and capture rights that I think are unnecessary to surrender, but are going to be very, very difficult to get back in our control.
Tim from Ladysmith, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Appreciate your guests and very insightful. One of the things I think that we just do not understand radical Islam in this country, and I think it's time we stop apologizing for what we're doing. There's nothing that we're going to do that's going to appease radical Islam. Had we not been in Saudi Arabia, they'd have found another excuse to attack us. And Vladimir Shubat, who was a former Palestinian terrorist, is traveling the college circuit with two other former terrorists trying to educate college students to the reality of radical Islam and their agenda. And I don't think you can appease it, and I think we need to stop trying to.
Lawrence.
I think that it's not possible to appease al-Qaeda. At one point, it had something of a political agenda. You know, it was to get the Americans out of the Arabian Peninsula, and they, as soon as that was accomplished, they went on to another goal. If you look at, you know, the bombings in Madrid, which I covered for the New Yorker, the stated goal of the first bombing, which killed 196 people in the Madrid train stations, the goal was to persuade the Spanish people to overturn their government and withdraw from Iraq, and that actually happened within days. You know, there was the national vote, the government was thrown out, a new government came in, promptly announced that they're going to pull their troops out of Iraq, and what happened, the same bombers attempted to create another bomb that would cause even more devastation. So the lesson I draw from that is that it's pointless to try to appease al-Qaeda. In fact, al-Qaeda is drifting into a kind of nihilistic, apocalyptic cult that I think is, you know, it's going to in some ways be the ruination of it, because, you know, I think fundamentally Muslims are going to realize that, first of all, they are the primary victims of al-Qaeda. Many times more Muslims have died at the hand of al-Qaeda than Americans died on 9/11. In Iraq alone, three or four times as many. And al-Qaeda offers nothing to the people that follow them. If you read the statements of bin Laden, for instance, in his recent, you know, videos where he complains about us not signing the Kyoto Treaty, for instance.
Right, right.
Well, what's his own environmental policy? What kind of economic model does he follow? He complains about American corporations, but he never says if he's a Marxist or a Keynesian or a free marketeer. They don't have a political agenda. In many ways, it's really not a political movement. In my play, I talk about it being like a snake bite. It's just an instinct, a reaction. And whenever you get into, and it's been tried before, you know, radical Islamist government in, say, the Taliban in Afghanistan or in Sudan or in Iran, it's it's a guaranteed failure because the Islamists are not interested in government. They're only interested in purifying the faith. And where that happens, government naturally fails to serve its people.
Lawrence, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Lawrence Wright, and the book has just been released in paperback. If you have not read it, it is it's quite a read and quite an important contribution, thus the Pulitzer Prize last year, to understanding why September 11 happened. The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. And it is written by Lawrence Wright, who writes for The New Yorker and who did a one-man play, The Looming Tower, last year, which was in New York. And he's a screenwriter and a staff writer for The New Yorker. And we thank Carmen Jackson for producing this hour and John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. I'm sorry we couldn't take all of your calls, everybody. We had tons of them this hour, and they were important contributions, but we just ran out of time. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.